talk about the prologue and the first commandment, and I don't want to do injustice to these very important things, so I'm going to get right into it, and we're going to do this by reading. We're going to start by reading Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 17, the Ten Commandments as given to Moses. We're going to read that together, and what I'm going to do is to kind of because the numbers of which commandment is which is not listed here. It doesn't say first commandment, this one. Second commandment, this one. So I'm going to point out how it's traditionally been divided. And I'm just going to say first commandment, and then we'll say it together and all that stuff. So if you guys would open up your Bibles with me to Exodus chapter 20, and we'll do this together. I think it will be a lot of fun. Okay. I really mean it. And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Now the first commandment, together, you shall have no other gods before me. Second commandment, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Third commandment, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath by keeping it holy. Fifth commandment, 6 days you shall labor, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or your daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in the 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. Six, you shall not murder. Seven, you shall not commit adultery. Eight, you shall not steal. Nine, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Amen. All right. I was thinking, with a subject as familiar and well-tread as this, if there is a possibility that we're going to be bringing a lot of assumptions about what it is already, and even just some of the myths around it, because we kind of have all of these kind of stuff that surrounds the Ten Commandments. We've seen movies, we read stories, we've had Bible studies. So we have a certain impression of, a certain image of how this occurred. So I want to start, to clear the table, I want to start by doing a little bit of an exercise, a fact or fiction kind of a thing. And I'm going to ask you guys to use your pen since all of you guys have it, and just write in your paper, nobody's going to grade it or anything, just write down fact or fiction. It will be relatively easy, just so that you guys are actually interacting versus kind of waiting for something to occur. So let's start with a real easy one, okay? You guys got what we're doing, right? Fact or fiction. Fact or fiction, real easy one. Moses originally received 15 commandments from God, but he dropped one of the tablets, so we only have 10. Fact or fiction. That one obviously is false. Extra points for anyone who knows the movie reference. But it is true that Moses, what? What's true about that statement? He did break the two tablets that he received, okay? He threw it down in anger when he saw the Israelites worshiping the golden calf. He came down with the Ten Commandments. So the set that they wound up getting and holding on to for many generations is the second, or the copy, the one that God actually gave as a second copy. It's a fascinating story. That's given in Exodus chapter 33 and 34. So God gave a second copy. He wasn't mad at Moses saying, why did you break that? of all the things to throw down in anger. My goodness. He didn't do that. He had mercy. He understood Moses' righteous anger. Okay, second one, fact or fiction. On the two stone tablets given to Moses, there were written five commandments on one. I said there are two stone tablets of testimony, okay? They were given five commandments on one and five on the other. And it's not a trick question where you go, no, was it four and six? Is it first three and the next seven? So we see this picture of, so write it down, make up your mind about what it is. Five and five. So the typical image that I always had, or the paintings that I've always seen as a kid growing up in Sunday school, Bible studies, or you see Ten Commandments somewhere in a church's wall somewhere, right? We all have seen this, and usually there's like a, on the first half, there's like a Roman numeral one. So Roman numeral two, right? And it's written in English, or sometimes they'll try to actually write something in Hebrew, but you never know whether it's true. I don't know. The answer is I don't know whether it's fact or fiction. But here's the interesting thing. The oldest Jewish tradition has it, holds that the tablets, both of the tablets, tablet one and tablet two, held the full set of the Ten Commandments. Okay? The oldest Jewish, the rabbinic tradition holds that the tablets had 10 on one and 10 on the other. Why? Now, this is true now as well, because the commandment establish a covenant. It's a treaty. It's the terms of a vow, right? It is likely that they were duplicated on two tablets. We just refinanced our house, and we signed everything in duplicates and triplicates or whatever else. And this is an ancient tradition of contracts, right? The diplomatic treaties that they found in the ancient in ancient Egypt, they found duplicate copies of these treaties, one for each party. And this actually is kind of significant. Why? Because the Ten Commandments are sort of a vow, and they list the terms of this covenant, right? We make these sorts of covenant vows all the time. Sometimes they're detailed out in explicit terms when you're using a realtor, or when you're using some sort of a service or an attorney, you give them the power of attorney. Sometimes in a very deep, meaningful ones, like in a marriage vow, there are some explicit terms of this agreement, and there's some implicit terms of this agreement, okay? And there are certain terms that fall outside of that marriage covenant as well. Just because the two of you decide that you're going to be, share your life together doesn't mean that you share absolutely everything, right? So there's some explicit terms of this marriage covenant. So what are some explicit terms of the marriage covenant? Being faithful, right? That's pretty explicit, right? That's pretty obvious. You, if somebody is not faithful, that is the terms of divorce, right? Legally it is. And in the Bible, in certain places, it's given as a legitimate reason, okay? Sharing of finances, legal terms, right? In California, at least in the state of California, when you get married, everything that you earn, whether you earn $1 million and your spouse earns, you know, $1,000 in a year, which is kind of like my house a little bit. No. Not even near a million, but the ratio might be the same. But everything that you earn is community property, right? Community property. You can't walk away saying, look, I did all the earning, so therefore I should have all this to my name. At the end of the day, it's everything that you join together, okay? Everything that you bring in is community property. But there are some explicit things, I'm sorry, there are certain things that it doesn't include, such as you don't get to walk away from a marriage because somebody gets, So another one that might be implicit is when somebody gets sick, a spouse doesn't get to walk away from the marriage in good conscience. You said in sickness and in health, but you don't get to walk away from that. But there's certain things that you don't include in that. It doesn't mean you share all your clothes, right? There's certain things that are just there. It doesn't mean that you have to immediately exchange every bit of personal history from your background. Those are things that are different. Ten Commandments are not just some universal principles of good living, but they are first and foremost the terms of a relationship contract that help us fulfill our vow to be God's people, okay? So that's an important one, okay? So that's the second one. Now, the last one is really a gimme as we transition into the meat of the sermon, fact or fiction. The two stone tablets are currently being stored in a super secret U.S. government warehouse. How many people say yes? How many people say no? Okay. How many people say, what are you talking about? Okay. See, that was actually a generation gap kind of a test to see how many people are with this. If you guys grew up watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, then you guys are saying, yeah, of course, it's hidden in a super secret U.S. warehouse. Anyways, I won't tell you whether that's fact or fiction, but one of the things that we want to do in this series is to point out some of the ways in which our previous learnings about the commandments, or the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, as they were originally called, okay? The Jews, the Hebrew, the actual term in Hebrew is literally the ten words, and that's why we use ten words of life, even though it includes more than ten words, but it would be talked about in terms of the ten words. We want to talk about some of the ways in which our previous learnings about the Ten Commandments may have fallen short, and I want to talk about four serious misconceptions about the Ten Commandments, or four ways in which we must not read the Ten Commandments. And so doing, give you a sense of why we think we need to study them at this moment in the life of our church. So the four things that I want to say is that the Ten Commandments are grace-driven. Second thing is that it's relationally driven. Third thing is that it's communally driven. And fourth thing is that it's worship-driven. So those are four things. And usually we don't think about the Ten Commandments in any of those four ways. And I think those are central. That's central to the way in which we understand the Ten Commandments, okay? So the first thing I want to say is that the Ten Commandments are grace-driven. Now, the general myth or the general thing that we say is that the Ten Commandments stand in contrast to the gospel. The Ten Commandments represent the law and as such have been surpassed by the gospel of grace that's presented by Jesus in the New Testament, right? Many of us grew up learning about the law or the Ten Commandments or the Old Testament, any parts of the Old Testament, kind of like this, right? It stands in contrast to the message of Jesus Christ, that the law is about people trying to please God by doing something with their work so that they might be saved, but grace is God simply having mercy on us. That's generally how we've been taught about the Ten Commandments. That's generally how we've been taught about the difference between the Old Testament and the New. Any of this sound familiar? Does this kind of ring a bell of how we may have grown up, how we may have been taught? I think the better way for us to understand the commandments is to see the consistency and not just in terms of the contradiction, not just in terms of the difference. Yes, there is a difference, but there is incredible consistency, and it's a message of grace. See, the reason why I'm doing this, I'm just going to show my hand, is that we have been given this image. The message is generally like this. Most of the gospel messages that I've been presented is that God had a plan A. And that's what God was trying to do with the Old Testament, with trying to save the people by the law. Plan A. But it didn't work. So God comes up with plan B, and he said, bring out the big guns. I'm going to bring out Jesus. Now, somewhere in most of us, in many of us, there are these vestiges of that little understanding of the Bible. There's little vestiges. It's stuck in there somewhere, even if we're not conscious about it. And it comes out when we think about God in terms of this either a bumbling kind of a God who has to have a plan A and then a plan B, or a God who kind of capriciously changes his mind about the direction of the history of the universe. I'm going to change my mind because I was going for plan A, but I'm just going to go plan B. And we see this, and how that gets played out, I think, and I know this seems like a kind of a technical point, but I think this gets played out in our lives when we encounter a difficulty or in times of stress, and we begin to doubt God's goodness toward us. When something bad happens, if we have that understanding, if we have that understanding of God, we have a tendency, I think, to think of God in a difficult situation, think of God and go, God, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? Are you for me? Do you love me anymore? We have these questions about who God is. Now, in times of stress, your theology, your understanding of who God is, that's what theology really is. Your understanding of who God is can either cause you anxiety or bring you hope. Okay? So I think there's some incredibly practical consequences of thinking about this rightly. Don't just take my word for it. Let's look at the Ten Commandments. Look at Exodus 20 with me again and see the consistency of who God is. The first words of the Ten Commandments are the prologue. And it starts off with this statement. It says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. It starts off with this statement. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Before any command, any commandment, any other requirements or anything, any law is uttered, God talks about the nature of this relationship, and it is already defined by what God has done. It is defined by God's salvific act that has already been accomplished. Notice the two pronouns. God is speaking. The I comes first. And then, if you look in the text, in the Ten Commandments, as you read chapter 20, the you comes next. But the first thing is the I. The first thing is what God does. The most important moving force behind the entirety of what moves us through the Ten Commandments is what God has already done. And indeed, this is precisely what Christ himself says. He says, I am the Christ who brought you out of your sin, out of the land of your slavery, right? Those are almost exactly the same words. So we can say, in no uncertain terms, the Ten Commandments begin with the gospel. The Ten Commandments begin with grace. God is still saving us from our Egypt, from our own lands of captivity, before we have done anything. There are no requirements for what God does, his act of mercy for us. Sometimes in the direst of our situations, we can think, God, what do I have to do? God, just tell me to do something to earn your salvation. What can I do to get free in this situation? And God reminds us, God says, I have already done the work. However difficult your situation might be, rest assured, know that I am the Lord your God. I have already brought you out of Egypt. I have already brought you out of your land of slavery. I have already brought you and broken your bondage and your captivity. Know this, and rest in that. That's the beginning of the Ten Commandments. It's grace-driven. Second thing, second point is that it's relationally driven. The Ten Commandments are relationally driven. I'm seeing this in the context because many of us, in our previous learnings, and I might be just as guilty of this, of having taught like this, is that we think about the Ten Commandments as some sort of an abstract law that's impersonal, universal, and kind of doesn't have any real connection. I mean, and so some people will say, you know, I really connect with Jesus. You know, when I think about Jesus, I just feel really warm and I sense a relationship. I really sense, you know, I connect with Jesus. But the God of the Old Testament, the God of the law, the God of the Ten Commandments, you know, he seems so distant. You know, he seems so kind of out there. And it's not something that I really relate to. And I want for us to see that that is probably a caricature of what happens and not really based on what we actually encounter here. The relationship is set out like this. I am the Lord your God. The relationship sets the context for the gospel. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of Egypt, out of land of slavery. You will have no other gods before me. And everything rests on these two pronouns. I am the Lord your God. And the command arises from this relationship between the I and the you. Okay? So, last week, Pastor Sam talked about, here's another way of doing it. Last week, Pastor Sam talked about how the word Lord, when it appears in the capital. So you guys need to open up your Bibles to Exodus 20 again. When it's all in capitals, it signifies the appearance of God's proper name, right? When it's all in capitals in the English Bible, the appearance of that signifies God's proper name. I want for us to count right now how many times the proper name of God, Yahweh God, capital letters L-O-R-D, appears in the Ten Commandments, verses 1 through 17. First person with an answer. Still counting. I hear whispers, but I don't really hear words. How many people say eight? Let's try that again. How many people say eight? Because it is eight, right? It appears eight times. In a span of the Ten Commandments, it appears eight times. Does that seem like a lot to you? Does that seem like a lot to you? Because it's not a very long passage. In fact, I can't think of another passage in the entirety of the Old Testament where God uses his name that openly, that freely, and says it eight times in that sort of a span. If you mention your name this many times in a conversation, what would that mean? What do you think? It'd be either your Elmo, because Elmo never uses the word I. That's for the parents. So they get this. Elmo doesn't say I. Elmo says Elmo. Anyways, I'm going to do an Elmo imitation. Or he's just a bit weird, right? But that would not have been received that way, of course, in the Bible. But what would have been obvious is the intentional emphasis. What everybody would have understood immediately was, wow, this is the holy name of God that we don't even get to utter without feeling like there might be a fire from heaven that comes down to strike us dead because we didn't say it right. That holy name of God gets uttered eight times in this little short text. God is emphasizing something. What? God is emphasizing himself. God is emphasizing himself and how personally involved he is in the giving of this commandment. God is taking a risk, which he acknowledges in the third commandment by saying, do not misuse the name of God. But he's saying this to say, this is me. This is not just some random abstract God. This is me with whom you are dealing with. And this is not just any me. This is me, Yahweh. The one who has saved you, the one who loves you, and you're making this contract, you're taking this covenant with me. You're doing this with me. That's how personal it gets for God. Add to this the fact that God himself, he does this twice, as we mentioned. He writes down the Ten Commandments himself. Moses breaks the first set, and God says, bring me another tablet. I will write it down again. What's that about? We all know the impact of personally writing something, right? You ever get a card from someone where they sign their name and it's printed out? How does that feel? Really personal? No. But when they write it with their hand, and it's an ink that smudges, that seems personal. The 10 words of life, God writes it, he writes it with his own hand. That's how personal, that's how involved God is. This is all about the relationship, folks. This cannot be abstracted from our relationship with God. That's the second thing. This God, this great God, the creator of the universe, the Lord of all lords, God of gods, takes a great risk in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are then an expression of God's love toward us. And the reason why we ought to love it is for that reason, not because we agree with it on some philosophical level and say, yeah, our world would be so much better if everybody followed the Ten Commandments. But no, because first and foremost, this is a letter of love toward us. The third thing that I want to say is that this is communally driven. A relationship with God is deeply personal, but the saying goes, it is never private. Our faith is deeply personal, but it is never private. But in the past, I think what happens in both the Ten Commandments, the way in which we approach the Ten Commandments, as well as the way in which we approach our faith, we have taken it incredibly individualistically. But these commands are deeply communal and community creating. When God says you in here, it is always in the plural and not in the singular. Now, you in the plural in the English is always something that's difficult to say because there is no separate word for the you singular versus you plural, right? But different regions and different dialects have come up with different ways of saying this. If you're from the South, my friends from Arkansas would say, y'all. Y'all coming to dinner? And it's a you in the plural. If you're from Brooklyn, you say, yous guys. Hey, all of yous. So the commands presume the formation of community and the need for community. The commands presume the formation of a community and the need for community. Let me talk about why that is and what that means. Why? First, because of everything that we've been saying about sin over the last few weeks, one of the first effects of sin is denial. One of the first effects of sin is self-deception about our own sinfulness. Let me say it like this. I don't know about you, but at least in myself, I can see sin in other people so much easier than I can see it in myself, right? At least, let's give it a number, 10 times easier. Now, I could go through the day thinking the reason for that is because everybody else is 10 times more sinful than I am. Or in those moments of clarity, I can say it's because it's a whole lot more difficult to see the sin in my own life. I need somebody else to point that out. Anybody else agree with me on this, or is this just me? So you guys are nodding. You say, yes, I can see the sin in you so much, so much easier than I can see the sin in me. Think about this. Think about how many times, think about how easy it is for us to see the hypocrisy in others. Anybody ever talk about somebody else's hypocrisy? I'm choking up right now. Anybody else ever just like point out just the hypocrisy in other people? But then when somebody might or perceive something that's hypocritical in your life, you immediately rationalize it. You immediately justify it. And so that's not hypocrisy. And you know in your head why it's not hypocrisy, right? Gossip. I bring up gossip because gossip is one of these things that I actually think I generally don't think I have. I struggle with gossip. It's one of those things that I think I don't. Gossip is not something that I do. And it's always a shock, though, when somebody else says, "Hey, Jen, that's gossip." My immediate response to that is, "I don't gossip. What are you talking about?" Until somebody else points that out to me, I am completely blindsided to how much I may participate in spreading of truth or even untruth that's unsubstantiated about somebody else not out of care, but out of malice or just the sense of feeling good about something. Being materialistic is another one, because this is something that we all participate in. Isn't it so much easier to notice how somebody else is living a life that's beyond their means? Isn't it so much easier, wives and husbands especially, isn't it so much easier when your husband buys something that you go, "You don't need that," to say that? And husbands, isn't it so much easier when you look at the way, you're like, "Do you really need to get that?" Right? Isn't it so much easier to see how somebody else is being materialistic or overspending or not using their resources? But you never, hardly ever think you're being materialistic. We always think we're buying the car that's right for us. We always think we're buying the shoes that are the right price because it's more comfortable. We always think whatever to justify our own purchases. Now, I'm not saying that everybody is therefore crazy and self-deluded. What I'm pointing to is that without community, it is really, really, really hard to see our own sin. And it is not enough, folks, even for you married folks, because you think I have that sort of accountability with my husband and my wife, because you guys, we can't even tell our spouses that, yes, indeed, that dress does make your butt look big, you know? We can't even say something like that. There are certain conversations that you can't ever say, you can't ever have. So there's certain accountability that is easier in the context of a different community that requires a larger community. You can't do 10 Commandments. You can't have a sober understanding of whether or not you're lying. You can't have a sober understanding of whether or not you are indeed worshiping God above all in your life without community. You can't. Impossible. Impossible. No matter how objective and high-minded we would like to think that we are, we need one another. I have a real hard time when somebody else speaks into my life Even when somebody does it in the gentlest manner, I know my immediate reaction is to respond defensively. But whatever maturity I've gained over time tells me that there's probably truth there that I need to heed. The second part of why we need community. If we think the only way, only requirement, the only reason we need community is because somebody else needs to tell us something, that's incredibly self-centered as well. And I mentioned this in the small groups. The objections. Because the Ten Commandments are given to us and given to us as a community, and guess what? We are being told to be responsible for one another and keeping them as well. Okay? So you have a responsibility to help the person across the aisle, even across this huge aisle today. Help that person keep the Ten Commandments. We have a responsibility for others. We don't get to just say, no, I'm doing okay. I think I'm doing okay with my sin life. It's in check. No, there's a sense in which we forget that you are needed to bring in who you are. The body misses you. The body misses you. So the Ten Commandments intimately, integrally understands a community in the mix. Let me say the last thing then. The Ten Commandments must be worship-driven. And it gets us into the first commandment. Following the Ten Commandments are not the surefire means of living your best life now. The reason why we follow God, God's commands, is not so that we can live our life to the fullest. It may sound familiar to you, but there's an approach toward spiritual life, there's an approach toward faith that makes it into a sort of a how-to or a plan or a method to make our lives as best as it possibly can be. And sometimes we are fed into that. And we can come here thinking that the Ten Commandments are some sort of a 10-step plan to make our lives better. And then we would think about God's words primarily in terms of, primarily, not that it's bad, but primarily in terms of whether it's relevant for me. But sometimes, something like worship, you will have no other gods before me, is profoundly irrelevant, at least on a surface level. You have to dig deeper to understand the relevance of that. Of course, every single one of these things has a practical consequence in our lives. And I do believe that indeed it will make our lives best. That's the best way of living our lives. That's the best, better way of saying it. But if that is the main reason why we come to church, if that is the main reason why we study God's word, if that is the main reason why we follow Ten Commandments, then we have made God into something we use or not use. One commentator said it like this really well. It says, we don't need God. We worship God. We don't do this out of a sense of need, but we worship God. We do this out of a sense of awe. We don't do this out of our desperation. We do this out of a sense of amazement of who God is. That is the first commandment, the commentator says. To stop attempting to get something out of God and instead to bend our lives toward God. And this person defines worship, a worshipful life, as a bending of a life. And I thought about, well, what does that mean? What does that look like? And I thought of a botanical illustration. How many of you guys know what heliotropism is? It's not that hard. You guys all kind of know it. I probably said it wrong. So heliotropism, right? Heliotropy? Okay. Nobody's familiar with it. It's helio is sun. Tropy is, tropy. Okay, so it's when, in botanical, when a plant moves to the direction of the sun, right? So we know that the sunflower does this, right? We know that the sunflower faces, and that's why it's called a sunflower, or is it because it looks like the sun? I'm not sure. But it faces the sun throughout the day, and it actually moves along with it, right? You know where the sun is by the direction in which the sunflower is bent, by the way in which the plant is bent, right? So plants do this. There is a sense in which it is attracted to light, and especially the sun. There are certain plants that will be attracted to that, and by the bend of the plant, you can see where the sun is. So here's how I'm thinking about it. What are the things then in our lives? If someone were to look at our lives and observe our lives, what would they say our lives are bending toward? What would they say our lives are leaning toward? A complete, neutral, objective observer, what would they say our lives are bending toward? What is the thing that occupies most of our time? What is the thing that occupies most of our emotional energy? What is the thing that occupies most of our resources, our anxiety, our stresses? Is it God? Now, you don't get to bend your life toward the sun. You don't get to bend your life by just saying, I'm going to bend my life toward God. You actually do it, right? The sun is, or whatever your life is bent toward, that is what you worship. That is what you're worshiping. So what are you worshiping with your life? What are you worshiping with your life? You don't get to say, I worship God, and that is at the center of my core, that the first commandment is the last commandment for me. I will have no other gods before him. I will have no other gods besides him. I will not even be distracted by any other gods. We don't get to say that. We don't get to do that. We don't get to live that out. We don't get to obey that simply by just saying it. We don't get to obey that command simply by blogging about it. Or putting it up on our Facebook, what are you thinking now? We don't get to obey that by singing about it energetically, even on Sunday mornings. We get to obey that. The way in which we obey that is how we live our lives, period, and what it is bent toward. What is your obsession? What is your obsession? And is it at the center pleasing God? What is at the core of your relationships? What is at the core of your relationship dynamics with other people? Is it about trying to find some way to get that person to do what I want? Is it about trying to find some way so that I might be liked by somebody? So that somebody might think highly of me? Or is it about somehow honoring God in that relationship? Because if that is at the core of your relationship, I guarantee you, this accountability stuff that I talked about that sounds so hard is not then as hard as you might imagine it. It is not impossible.
If that is at the core of your relationships, then the issue and struggles that we have with gossip starts to go away. Because the way in which we start to talk about other people is not to bring them down, but we start to talk about other people because we care about them. And that has a very different bend in your life. We have been created to worship. Our lives will bend towards something. That's what God is telling us by the first commandment. And He's telling us that the right thing, that the thing that your life was indeed made to worship, is God, who has already saved you, who has already broken your bondage, who has already freed you from all of your captivity. What is your life bent toward? And if we're being honest, I think most of us would admit to some creation. And I think Pastor Sam's probably going to get to that next week as we talk about idolatry. Because there are lots of wonderful things, beautiful things in creation. Incredible things that are meant to be loved, but not to be loved before God. And we think, as long as it's not a bad thing, then we can love it even above God. I think that's our biggest mistake. The test of a life of the one who has no other God before Christ is not simply saying so, not even talking about it, not even praising exuberantly or even preaching about it, but in the living it, in the loving it, and letting the truth of God's goodness flow out of us in some way, in some form, so that others might see by the bend of our lives who and where God is. Let's pray.